So would you like to look at page 91 of the handbook and the sheet with the verses on? We want to look at page 2, verse 6 at the bottom. Okay. Handbook, it's page 91. Topic 2, principal applications. Verses, it's page 2 at the bottom, verse number 6. Can you help our friend there with these papers here? So the topic is applications, principal applications, but we call that trainings. The first section of this topic is the person who engages in the trainings. You see, so the first topic is what you train in. You train in those 173 aspects. And how do you train in them? Then that's where these trainings come in this chapter. The trainings on the basis of the 173 aspects, theoretically. The first section of that trainings or applications chapter, then, is the person who engages in the trainings, which you can see from the handbook. Bottom of page 91, top of page 92, takes up two verses. So you can compare my translation with the translation in the book. All the other verses, the first four verses in this chapter, have all been taken up with the 173 aspects. You can see the 173 aspects are not listed exhaustively. They're just summarize, just give the numbers and, just give a few of the names without going into all the details. So all of that we've studied is just a huge expansion of very condensed verses. So verse number 6 and number 7 then. Whose conduct toward the Buddhas was supreme, amidst them have grown virtuous roots, who've had protective spiritual friends, their vessels for listening to this. They served the Buddhas, asked and did the deeds of giving ethics all, so those most worthy beings are deemed the vessels who will take up and retain and such. So, to put some meaning on those words. So we're talking about the vessels who are kind of the people who do the trainings. They're the vessels, the suitable vessels to receive the trainings, as it were. Hold on. That's not it. So four different types of vessels are given. Four different types of people who receive the teachings, four different levels of progress that they make or whatever, and four levels of what they've done in order to get to be suitable vessels. So let's sort those out. So the first lot are those who listen. You know, the first verse is just one lot of vessels. So they're the people who simply listen to the teachings. So you've got whose conduct towards the Buddhas is supreme, who amidst them have grown virtuous roots, who've had protective spiritual friends. They're the vessels for listening to this. Okay? And then the next verse has got the other three kinds of vessels, all are kind of, you know, just condensed up into one verse. So they served the Buddhas, asked and did the deeds of giving ethics and all, that means all the perfections, giving ethics and so on. So those most worthy beings are deemed the vessels who will take up, retain, and search. So taking up the perfection of wisdom, I think that means, you know, the person who takes to mind the perfection of wisdom, and as in the handbook on page 92, it says, one who memorizes and remembers the words of the Perfection Wisdom Sutras. So they don't just hear, and it goes in one ear and out, in one ear and out of the other. They memorize, they remember the words, maybe even memorize them as well. Yeah, but it's still probably on the level of listening, or just, you know, the people who the wisdom arisen from listening. Yeah. So those are the ones who, in the last line there, they will take up the perfection of wisdom, take up the meaning of the words, memorize them. But then number three, then it says retain. What about the ones, the third type of vessel is those who will retain those meanings. So retain the meanings or holds the meanings. So that means that's the one who, yeah, they retain the meaning of the words. So they don't just remember the words, they don't just memorize the words, but they get, connect. They remember the explanations, so they get the meanings of the words as well. Yeah. So, as it says, they are kind of, you know, they've asked questions and so forth, so they've cleared up their doubts. So that's maybe talking about the wisdom risen from reflection, you know, through contemplating the meaning, for getting the meaning right, then thinking about the meaning, then an inferential cognizer realizing the meaning can arise. You see, that would be the wisdom arisen from reflection, perhaps. And then the further one, it says, and such. So that's leaving the fourth type of vessel. What they're doing is that leaves it to be supplied, doesn't it? But it, in the handbook, it says the fourth one is the one who properly reflects on the meanings and also practices them to the proper conduct of the ten perfections. Because it says in the, earlier in verse 7, you know, they also did the deeds of giving ethics and so forth. So they've practiced the perfections, the six perfections or the ten perfections. You know, so they've reached a further ability in their level of understanding. So they can maybe have got to the stage of being the way it's the wisdom arisen from meditation, which I think means a wisdom arisen from a union of calm abiding, special inside. I don't think it means you have to realize the meaning directly. The wisdom arisen from meditation, it has that wisdom arisen from, you know, a union of calm abiding, special inside. I think that's right. You don't have to actually realize directly. But I'd like to check up on that if I have time. Okay, so how do we... The next part of the explanation in the handbook is just how do you become a vessel of that type? So that's what's detailed. That's the other points that are detailed in these verses. So I'm looking at the commentary here. Well, you've got the four types of people anyway. So there's ones who are listening. So I thought that meant... The first level is just listening. So, you know, it's like a kid at school. They hear the lesson, and maybe they enjoyed listening to the lesson. But when they go home and the mum asks them what they heard, what was the lesson about? Well, they can't remember. So gone in one ear and out of the other. So they listen to the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, but it doesn't really kind of, you know, it doesn't really sort of get to them yet. And then the next one, number two, so they can It says retained, isn't it? Take up. The second one is taking up. Taking up the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. So they hear and remember the words of the lesson, but doesn't necessarily know what the meanings are of those words. Maybe they can remember, even memorize the words, you know, some new words like latitude or longitude or something. So the kid hears these words and remembers the words. But when his mum asks him what they mean, he really can't really say very well. I don't know. Maybe that's hard to take it. But then the next one, the one who retains, you know, their interest is in the words, they get the meaning of the words. And then they've questioned and they've got the answers too, you know. So they've got a real understanding, reflection, contemplation, wisdom realizing, risen from reasoning. And the last one, you know, that's the kid who really assimilates the meaning. He practices it and enjoys it. So he gets the fruit, he gets the benefit of the lesson. You know, he really understands, gets the new knowledge. And, you know, that new knowledge helps him to improve himself. So how do we get to be each of those types of vessels? Well, it gave three acts for the person who's listening, didn't it? So for the person who's listening, who listens, who gets enough merit to listen, to hear the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, they have their conduct towards the Buddha as the supreme. So they've accepted exceptionally towards numberless Buddhas in the past. Well, that's asking a lot, isn't it? Not just one Buddha, but numberless Buddhas. They've acted, their conduct towards those Buddhas was very good. That's a bit of asking a lot, really. They've shown great respect to numberless Buddhas in the past. For example, constructing residences for Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, temples and so forth. Okay, then they've also planted roots of virtue with regard to those Buddhas. So that seems to mean things like making offerings to those Buddhas. Serving the Buddhas. Planting roots of virtue with regard to them. By doing things for the Buddhas or in relation to the Buddhas, then they've created that kind of very special virtue in relation to the very special field of merit. And then also they've been under the guidance or protection of Mahayana spiritual friends. So through being under the guidance of those, then been guided or to create the karma to be able to listen to the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So that's that was the verse number 6. Then verse number 7. Those who are able to not just listen to the teachings but actually memorize, remember the words, then those are the ones who served the Buddhas. Served countless Buddhas, it says again. Then the ones who are able to retain the meaning, not just memorize it, but retain the meaning and without forgetfulness properly, then they are the ones who've questioned the Buddhas. So when they've had doubts, they've raised their doubts and had them sorted out. So they sorted out the words and the meanings. And then the ones who, having taken up, retained, and then after that, one who properly, you know, has reflected on them and practices them, so then that practices them through the 10 perfections. So those are the ones, you know, who, the ones who've practiced giving ethics and so forth, they're the best kind of vessel. So those are the ones who, are able to practice the teachings. You know, they've assimilated to the point where they can practice them properly. So maybe with the wisdom arisen from meditation. So it's just giving, in those two verses, it says the people who engage in the trainings. So that's how it's explained. And then the trainings themselves, or the applications, there's quite a lot of verses, which I haven't translated, because Don't have that much time. But then you can see there's quite a lot of applications in different groups. In the main text, there's four applications, four trainings. Yeah. So when you divide perfection of wisdom up, you know, there's the three first chapters, which are knower of all aspects, knower of bodhisattvas, knower of the path, and then knower of all aspects. Yeah. Then the next four chapters, as I said, was this one, which is the training in complete aspects. Then there's the peak training. Then there's serial training. And then there's the instantaneous or momentary training. So if somebody asks you what are the four trainings that these bodhisattvas do when they're actually, you know, headed for enlightenment, all the way from path of accumulation, all the way through to the path of no more learning, when you ask what trainings they do, then it's easiest just to say those four trainings that are included in the eight categories. So in my verses, it's on page 1, verse number 4. Yeah, so those are the main trainings. Full realization of all aspects. That's the complete training in aspects, which is this chapter. Then you've got gone to the peak. So the next one is once you've gained mastery in those 173 aspects, then you start to sort of practice them as they should be practiced. That's at the peak level. And then, you know, once you get sort of really well versed in them and can do them all in a series quite quickly, then that's a serial training. And then the last training is when you can do them very, very quickly. You can do them all in an instant, which is, you know, as soon as you can do that, then your Buddhahood comes along in the next moment. So those are the four main trainings. So I'm quite happy just to stick with those, really. Here you get all these different trainings, but as we'll read a few of them, but you'll see that they're not... there's no kind of, you know, vivid explanation that you can give, really, that sort of separates them all out for them in some wonderful way. The first five are to do with the emptiness, we can say that. So this is a grouping. So this is page 94 in the handbook. So you've got 20 different trainings here in this text, in this chapter, in this section, I mean. And they're divided into five groups. And the first of the five groups, number one, the first group is by way of the entities of the applications. So that's always difficult to know what they mean by entities. Yes, but they all seem to be like meditation in terms of meditating on emptiness. So just read through a few of them, but as I say, there's not much we can say beyond what's just written down here, how to differentiate them. Some real scholar of perfection of wisdom might be able to do that, but I can't. So probably the first two are the most important ones. Application of not abiding in forms and so forth. So this application or this training realizes the phenomena included within basis, paths, and aspects are all not truly existent. So that's just realizing the emptiness of true existence, the ultimate nature of all, you know, the phenomena that you like to bring along. The basis, probably the basic Four Noble Truths, 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. And then paths, yes, all the paths that the bodhisattvas know about, they're all empty too. And then all the 173 aspects, they're all also empty of true existence. And then number two, you see, is the application of stopping the application, the training of stopping the training. So this is the application or the training which then says, yes, you know, even that training you know, the training of not abiding in forms and so forth, even that is also empty of true existence. So it's not just the object that the mind focuses on is empty of true existence, but the mind focusing on that object, the mind training by realizing the emptiness of that object, this mind is also empty. So those first two just about cover everything, really. So they're pretty comprehensive, aren't they? Nevertheless, there is another lot of trainings to mention, but what's especially, you know, different about these other trainings that come along, I can't say. Number three, for instance, the application realizes that the thusness of those forms and so forth included within basis are profound. So thusnesses, is that just another name for emptiness or suchness? So this training realizes that the emptiness of those forms and so forth that we've just been talking about, everything within the basis, are profound. Okay, yes, fine. So number four, application of the difficult to fathom. So this application or training realizes that the thusness of those forms and so forth within the paths are difficult to fathom. Yeah, well, that's not surprising. It is emptiness. It will be difficult to fathom. But little bit difficult to go beyond that and say what would it be like to meditate on that? I don't know. So the number five, the application of the immeasurable. So this application realizes that the thusness of those forms and so forth, included within aspects, are immeasurable. Yeah, so explanation doesn't really go beyond there. You know, if you take the Tonkapa's commentary on the Ornum of the Clear Realizations, which is Golden Rosary, it's called, or, you know, the standard textbooks that we study in the monastery, say, well, what are we supposed to make of those? Well, that's about the depth to which they go, really. So there's not much that we can sort of say, well, we're missing by passing on from those. So you just, those are the sort of final kind of, you know, divisions of the trainings, but maybe you have to be some kind of advanced bodhisattva to see the subtle differences between those. But they're not all, you know, they're not all about emptiness, but they're not all of them, there's not much about that we can say about them. So in the next group, there's one on its own, number six. So this is group number two, application by way of the persons who are the supports of the applications. So I think it's talking about different types of faculties. You know, those with sharp faculties can practice these trainings. But somebody with dull faculties, this is a training that particularly applies to them or something. So number six, application that realizes emptiness over a long time and with great difficulty. Yeah. So, you know, those, I think we should sort of jump over the rest of them, really. Number seven, application of receiving prediction. This is the application of a bodhisattva on the heat level of the path of preparation who receives a prediction of his future attainment of Buddhahood from the Buddha. Yeah, so that's a apparently something that happens on the path of preparation, that your concentration becomes, you know, very advanced. At the heat level of path of preparation, you haven't got your union of calm abiding special insight yet. But, you know, you've got enough concentration or whatever it is that you need to be able to see your Buddhas directly. I don't think, you know, like, whether you get teachings from them, maybe even get teachings from them, but this one is able to receive a prediction about where in the future, where and when he will attain Buddhahood. So you can pass through those trainings, the rest of them in your own time, just see, get the flavour of them, because there's not much I can add to them, really. So let's go to the next topic. So the next topic is the qualities of the application. So that means good qualities. So this is topic number three now, which is on page 98. In terms of verses, there's only two lines. So this is number 12. Verse number 12 on page 3. Demolishing the Mara's power and such. The 14 types of qualities. So through doing these trainings that we've just had mentioned, then, you know, you achieve certain qualities. You have certain benefits. So these 14 here are the benefits they are praising as, you know, the fruit of doing those practices. And it says these excellent qualities, just in the first paragraph, by the force of cultivating the Mahayana applications presented in the second topic, the Bodhisattva will achieve 14 types of excellent qualities. These qualities are presented in order to inspire the practitioner to cultivate the applications. Okay. So, the first, only one is mentioned in the text. It's very typical of the way the Ornum of Clear Realizations is written. It will tell you how many there are and just give you one as an example, or just probably the first one or the first two, or, you know, group them into groups and just give you, you know, how many groups there are or something. So then it doesn't give you all the divisions. So here we've got 14 different qualities. So the first one is overcoming the might of Maras. Through cultivating an application, the Buddhas receive blessings from the Buddhas, whereby they overcome the might of the Maras. There are four types of Maras, but in general, Maras can be any being who jealously hinders those who are cultivating the path. Yes, does a Mara have to be an actual being? I don't know. Do you know what the four Maras are? You've heard of the four Maras. Say that again. Yeah, your affliction. So, I don't think a Mara has to be a sentient being. Death is a Mara, but nobody seriously means that death is an actual being. It's personified as a lord of death, but I don't think they actually mean that death is a sentient being. Just sort of portraying him as a sentient being in a picture, but it's not actually a sentient being. So what to say about the four Maras then? Well, there is a note there. So we can just quickly look at that. But they've given the wrong page number in the note. It's actually on page 184. Maras are hindrances to practicing the Dharma. For more details, refer to the explanation of the four Maras described in topic 11. Well, it doesn't actually give you a page number, does it? But it's on page 184. There is a little section on the Maras, interestingly enough. So these do come in. You know, why is Buddha a conqueror? If you ask for sometimes they call the Buddha the victor, the conqueror, the triumphant one, yes? So then if you ask for an explanation, why is a Buddha a victor or a conqueror? It's because he's overcome the four Maras. That's one way of explaining that epithet for the Buddha. So these bodhisattvas who meditate, I'm not sure they've overcome the might of the Maras as completely as the Buddha has. But here it says, well, they overcome the might of the Maras. But, you know, you don't abandon afflictions until you actually, on the, you know, the final, last moment of a sentient being, you've still got afflictions, according to the Svatantrikas. So one of the Maras being the afflictions, you know, it doesn't mean you've actually got rid of them like a liberated being. So if you're a bodhisattva, you know, still on a higher ground, you still have some traces of the afflictions. In this school, you know, they abandon the afflictions, the obscurations of the afflictions, the obscurations of the obscurations of knowledge simultaneously, or the last moment of being a sentient being, you see. So you I don't think they mean completely overcome. Anyway, so briefly, the four Maras are the Mara of the aggregates, so it's your own aggregates. Yeah? So having contaminated dodgy aggregates like we have is a hindrance to making good progress on the path. Of course, having a precious human rebirth is, you know, that's the best deal going in Satya existence, so it's not like we're just sort of seeing the negative side of things and nothing else. So it's good to have human aggregates, but you know, they interfere with our progress because we get sick, or you know, we get physical afflictions which affect the state of our minds and prevent us sort of thinking clearly, and so forth. So you can even distinguish this Mara of the aggregates into two. There's a coarse Mara of the aggregates, which is the common one that we have. Sort of aggregates thrown by afflictions of karma, so naturally they're in a state of either causing a suffering or being liable to cause a suffering in the near future because of being so contaminated. So that's the kind of aggregates that we have. That's that hindrance. But also it says even here that the last line of the paragraph on the Mara of the aggregates, you can also talk about the subtle Mara of the aggregates, which is the mental body that arises in dependence on a level of the latency of ignorance, which is possessed by Hinayana foe destroyers. That's a good one. So Hinayana foe destroyers, they've got rid of the afflictions, right? So they're not born in cyclic existence again. They're not going round and round with, you know, gross contaminated bodies like us. But still, do they have a body? Well, it says they have a mental body. So when they're up there in Nirvana, meditating serenely on emptiness or selflessness, or whether they meditate on this school, they still have some kind of body, mental body, it says. So that's also a Mara. Why is it a Mara? Because I guess it's like a hindrance to being on the Bodhisattva path or something, you know, because that's what keeps you in your state of solitary seclusion of you know, peace, or something like that, your tranquility of solitary liberation. You're sort of, you know, in there, because you're sort of associated with this mental body, that's your support for your consciousness at that time of, you know, solitary liberation. So even that mental body is criticized as a Mara, because it's a hindrance towards you, you know, being on the path to Buddhahood or something. So the Buddhas at some point have to come along and tap you on the shoulder and say, get out of there, you know. Now it's time to go onto the Buddha's path, the Bodhisattva path. Are you with me? Or does that all sound a bit like you've never heard before or something? Yeah, we're only on the first one, okay. Got three to go. Fit him in somewhere. Yeah. Anyway, so there's probably a lot that maybe people don't understand. I don't know. Maybe you do understand. But if you're a Hinayana foe destroyer, in this school, there is only one final vehicle. So even those people go to solitary liberation, individual liberation, the Hinayana path, they've got Buddha nature. Everybody's got Buddha nature. Mahayanist, right? It's nobody you can't make it to Buddhahood. But if you go to your solitary liberation, you cut yourself off from Buddhahood for eons, you know, for such a long time. If you stay in samsara, you can work towards Buddhahood. The bodhisattvas don't go to solitary liberation. It's like a, you know, it's like a cul-de-sac, a dead end. You know, you pray to the Buddhas, please save me from the pains of samsara and, you know, the tranquility of peace. The bodhisattvas don't want to go either of those places. But eventually, the hearers themselves, they do get onto the bodhisattva path. When we talk about the path tomorrow, we can talk about that. Somebody who starts off on the hearer path, and then they can transfer to the bodhisattva path. They can transfer while they're on one of the learner paths, or they can transfer to the bodhisattva path after they've reached their foe destroyerhood. You know? So is that all new to you, or you kind of heard that before? Anyway, you see what's happening? So they're just criticizing also as a mara of the aggregate that even a hearer, solitary hearer, has. Okay, you're all switching off now. Okay, we've had a lot of learning today, plenty more tomorrow, so we should do a bit of meditation. But if we can get through these, the rest of the maras, the mara of afflictions, so that's the mara of the obscurations of the affliction. So the actual afflictions, the nyamongs, you know, the states of anger and attachment and so forth, which keep us doing, you know, dodgy actions, contaminated actions, which ripen up as further rebirth in samsara. They've got rid of them, you know. That's a mara. That's a kind of, you know, something got to be got rid of, but a real hindering influence, real sort of, you know, that's what's dragging us down and kind of keeps us drowning samsara. Okay? So those mainly hinder the attainment of liberation, right? Yeah, so that's the ones the hearers get rid of. Of course, the Buddhas have got to get rid of them, but just getting rid of them doesn't get you to Buddhahood. It just gets you to the state of being, you know, solitary peace. But that's, of course, that's a big drawback, a big hindrance to your finding, you know, the final state of peace and happiness. Okay, then you've got the mara of the Lord of Death. So, yeah, death is like a mara in the sense that it keeps happening. So every time it happens, everything you've built up towards, you know, positive force of getting alignment, it all gets interrupted. You know? It's a great interrupter of life's aspirations and hopes, isn't it? So you have to keep dying over and over again. So this is like kind of, you know, a real obstruction, a real hindrance to us. But as I say, Lord of Death doesn't mean that it's a person. I think it's just a way of, you know, giving it a sort of a person, personality when it, just for the purposes of portrayal. It's not kind of actually a being. But of course, you know, when our life gets keep interrupted again and again like that, of course it's a kind of, you know, hindering force, suitable to be called a mara. And the last one, the mara of the son of the gods. So this is defined as a category of the four maras that hinders passing beyond the other three maras as an included in a class of desire realm gods. You see? So that's the one that I think the mara that they talk about when Buddha is meditating on the Bodhi tree or other times when people are attacked by maras. You know, it can be an outside sentient being sort of who takes delight in hindering your progress. Some people say, no, the mara, that mara of the Gosim, even the son of gods, you should just think of it as you know, your sort of afflictions of desire and so forth. But it seems to me like, you know, it's considered one of the, you know, sort of gods who likes to do dirty tricks, you know, is like opposed to people making spiritual progress. So it will try and interfere with you if you are, if you give it a chance. So the maras, they're kind of, you know, just sort of, I think it's sort of like devil in Tibetan. Mara is the Sanskrit word. But it's, you know, let's say, not just sort of the classic case of devil as a person, but including that. Okay, so that's one of the qualities of practicing these trainings properly. So the other qualities, we could read through them, but, you know, we have to do some jumping. I think we'll have to call it a day there. If you want to do a bit of meditation for the rest of the time we've got, because we're getting pretty tired now. So that's the quality of the applications. So then tomorrow we'll look at the faults of the applications. Okay? So let's just try a bit of meditation. Too much talking, sorry, but you know, it's a lot to get through. So if we can try and put some of that, some of the meanings we've heard today, some of them at least are suitable for bringing out of the heart and really trying to, you know, pass from just hearing the words and from reflecting and understanding the words through actually, you know, sort of adopting them in our heart, making us see things that way, you know, making those virtuous mental factors stronger in our minds. And they're sort of the antidote, the temporary antidote at least, to afflicted states of mind until we can realize emptiness or selflessness and really destroy the afflictions forever. So first, just breathing meditation, silent meditation. Just let the mind relax. Find a balance. Also the body, make sure that's relaxed. You want to keep the spine straight, but just make sure there's no tension unnecessarily anywhere else. So having calmed our minds, let us try to become aware that the Buddha is present with us. Even the Buddha's, you know, indivisible from the Guru, if we have faith in a particular Guru. Enlightened beings are not restricted by time and place. So, ever present with us. We can visualize, just sense, just be open to their presence. Hard for us to have the karma to actually engage or, you know, perceive. But isn't it possible to go beyond our limited states of mind? If the mind's transformability, isn't it possible that there is a state of complete Buddhahood? And that we too, we have the seed of that, we have the potential. So just try to open up to those amazing possibilities. So let the Buddhas inspire our thoughts now. Beyond the mundane level. Samsara, we maybe can't say, is an unsatisfactory just in and of itself. Nothing is anything just in and of itself by way of its own character. Samsara is unsatisfactory when we have something to compare it with, which is so much better. From the perspective of, you know, those higher states, the joys that the Bodhisattvas experience, the bliss of Buddhahood, then we look down on samsara and say, oh, yes, that's pathetic really. Those superior beings, the ones who have gone to direct realization of emptiness especially, you know. It causes revulsion in their minds to contemplate samsara. So they're calling us away.
But the dividing line between being on Mahayana path, great vehicle path to Buddhahood, and not being on it is mind generation. Great vehicle mind generation. Mind generation is the wish for others' sake, perfect, full enlightenment. So we really have to have that broad mind that everybody matters. For the greatest saints in any religious tradition, any sort of, you know, really pure religious tradition, must be those who can look upon even the most wicked of other beings and see their value, see, you know, sort of forgiveness or something for their sins, not condemn them. So nobody's to be left out. Everybody has Buddha nature. But how are we to help them? We need a special state of knowledge and ability, wisdom and energy, not just enough to have this love for them and a kind of a seeing them as precious and as dear, but we also need to have the skill, the insight, which means that our interventions can be effective. So we need to aim for the highest. We need to aim for Buddhahood. So how do we get to Buddhahood? Well, the trainings are very numerous. The trainings are when detailed in our text, many, many shades, many, many divisions, many, many things to count. But for sure, we know that the Bodhisattva has to practice those 6 perfections, or 10 perfections. So give a thought to the ones we just mentioned today. Generosity. Our real wealth then is what we can give away, not what we've got kept hoarded up and just not doing anything. But the real wealth, the ones that the wealth that really does bring happiness for us, as well as anybody else, is what we give away, what we use to benefit others. That's our wealth. Highest form of morality, what's that? You know, let the suffering ripen on me, let others have the happiness. Very challenging teaching. Accept the defeat, give away the victory. And then patience. When there is no self, who is there to be harmed? If we respond to harm done to us by meditating impermanence, selflessness, then we can really feel that the enemy is doing us a favor by giving us that opportunity to practice when it really matters. So we'll have to stop there. We can just mentally dedicate our merits for a moment and then we'll say the prayer. So we have dedication prayers on the last page of the booklet, page 34. Well, there's only one there, isn't there? Maybe we know the other one anyway.
Kewadi nyoduda. Lama Sangye Drugyone, Drowa Chigyang Malopa, Kyaki Sala Gopa Shov, Chan Chu Sem Chorim Boche, Ma Kya Panam Ke Gyochik, Ya Panyam Pa Me Baya, Gong Me Gong Du Pel Ba Shov.
Then long life prayers.
Tup su jang xin jam gung kyao wei, ten zin kya bel wei kun zi do pa zi, cha sum go wei leng men tu ru, ba dang so du je gung du shab den sho. Gang ri ra wei ko wei xin kam de, and then now I'm all alone when I can raise the one thing in God so I shall be the body then your chi.
Thank you. See you tomorrow, I hope.
So have fun with your gold pens. And anybody can think what to do with the ones that are too big. I don't know.